Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Excellent.
Yep,
welcome to the show, everyone. Today we're joined by Pete Dignan. Pete is Head of Piston Heads Engineering and Consumer Engagement at CarGurus. CarGurus is the number one most visited car shopping site in the US, to give that a little plug there. And thanks for coming on the show, Pete. Thanks for taking the time to do this. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's good to be here and good to chat through things.
Yeah, cool. And I hope you don't mind, as we kick off this podcast, I have been doing a little bit of research and apparently your nickname is Racing Pete. Now I can kind of imagine what that might be, but can you give us a bit of background on that?
Yeah, so a bit of background, which might be helpful for later on as well. So first off, I wanted to be a pilot in the Air Force and had a scholarship through sixth form, but I played with computers too much and my eyesight stopped working, so they wouldn't let me fly planes with being blind.
Right.
So I then tried to be a professional racing driver, and I claimed to be a very failed professional racing driver because I'm not professional now and ended up in technology. So that is where Racing Pete really comes from.
Oh, right.
Because I used to race.
Oh, right, cool. I didn't realize that they still did those kind of like, you had to have 20/20 vision to fly. I thought that was just a myth. Is that actually true?
Well, back in, 1996 when I went through that stuff, yes. By then, yeah.
Blimey.
They did. Yeah, they'd let you, if your eyesight changed once you'd been trained, because it costs multi-million pounds to train you, they're like, yeah, fine, keep going. But to select you in, it was perfect vision. I think they've changed the rules now.
Wow, my God, that's crazy. We'll definitely get more into that. But how did you transition from that into technology then? What was that journey like?
So I was into computers sort of growing up as a kid. I'm one of those strange people who never had the internet through school, but had the internet through their working life. So I went and did a computer science degree at Loughborough University. So doing that and trying to race at the same time. So that's kind of the sort of segue, keeping something sensible to go to if it didn't work out.
Yeah. Oh, cool. So that what's CarGurus as a service then? What service do you provide there?
CarGurus was kind of founded in the US, as you were saying in the intro. So it was founded by Langley Steinhardt, who was one of the co-founders of TripAdvisor. And I think what he did was he went, well, we've sort of done the TripAdvisor. We've looked at kind of reviews for the travel industry, whatever industry is worth kind of trying to challenge and trying to go into. And he looked at retail or looked at housing and then looked at cars and decided automotive was one that needed to be challenged. And they launched in 2006 to try and take on the US market. There were some established players there.
Yeah.
And they came up with sort of technology solutions to try and actually take it on. So that's kind of where they went, which is really around just how do you buy your next car and trying to do that whole car buying journey and sorting that part out, which they did in the US. And then in the UK, they moved about 2015 into UK. Mm. And I think if anyone's bought a car recently and seen across, like there's Auto Trader, which has a dominant place in the UK market. And the CarGurus is to challenge that dominance, really.
Wow.
And it's brought in things into the UK market which weren't there before, such as what we call is this instant market value, which gives you whether the car is overpriced, underpriced, which if you notice on Auto Trader, they brought in probably in the last 2 years as well. So it's trying to challenge these markets to try and take on major competitors who are already there.
Yeah, it's a huge, you've got some major competitors, and you mentioned that you're kind of providing tech solutions for a lot of the issues that are out there now, or have been. And what are some of those tech solutions that you're solving with CarGurus?
So the challenge is, it's like, if you're buying a car, there's several things you want to know about buying that car. One, am I getting good value?
Yeah.
Because do we trust dealers as much as we trust dealers? So, yeah, are they overpricing or underpricing a car? And you've got this, you know, you go and look at the same model and it's range from like 10,000 to 20,000 for the car. What's the difference between that? So one is going, am I paying a good price for that car? So looking at various factors such as the age of the car, how many miles it's done, what options are fitted. So you can get a good price for the car and go, what's actually in market value for that car? And the second thing is then going, well, is the car going to break down? Is it going to be reliable? That's kind of the next thing you worry about when you buy a car. And then the third part is just making sure the transaction is successful and I can easily, you know, get the car to me. And I think sort of across those spaces is the kind of things we're looking at to try and solve the problem of that whole car buying journey. And the next extension then is piston heads, the bit I kind of work predominantly on, is really around that kind of 360 view of owning the car as well. So it's then about the ownership piece. How do you chat about the car? How do you ask people who also have the cars that can help you, you know, solve a problem or even choose your next car, where you go, well, I've got this criteria that, you know, I've got four kids and I need to get a seven seater. What's decent out there that won't make me want to drive into the central reservation because it's a dull car, that kind of stuff. So, so it's about then the finding part as well.
Amazing, amazing. How old is the business? When was it founded?
Cargo was founded in 2006. Piston Heads is much older. Piston Heads was founded in 1998. So it's a bit of a granddad in the internet world to some extent.
How much has it scaled in that time?
Yeah, it was a slow burn to start off with. So yeah, there's still some people working in the organization who are like in the top 20 sort of first employees in the US. And the idea was to sort of accelerate in a way that means you can maintain profitability to some extent. I know there are a lot of companies out there that go massively for revenue growth and kind of just get venture capitalists to try and fund them to accelerate that growth. Cargo is very much about a more slower, but more resilient play in the market to get there. So the growth has probably accelerated in the last five, six years, really, in the US more for growth of the actual size of the company and revenue. And it's really from when it launched on the stock exchange, which I think was back in 2017.
Cool.
I'll be guessing.
Cool. Well, 15 years is quite a substantial amount of time, especially in terms of technology, because the amount of tech changes or developments that happen in like even 3 or 4 years is crazy. So how have you kept up, or how has the business kept up with those changes at Cargo's and Piston Heads over that period of time? I mean, how do you personally keep up with developments?
Yeah, it's a challenge because, as you say, you know, one, you have challenges of coming to the market of completely different business models, which you've got to, you know, compete with. And then you've got technology stacks that change all the time. And the challenge you have with long-established business is that the technology stack you have, you know, suddenly becomes redundant and you've got all these features you've built in older pieces of technology. So managing technical debt and trying to solve that while accelerating your business is one of the probably biggest challenges you have as an established internet company, as opposed to those challenges come in who can, you know, straight away jump onto, oh, we'll just build the whole stack in serverless with React and off we go. And we're starting from scratch. It's a greenfield. It's exciting for, you know, engineers to come in because it's like complete greenfield and all new tech. Well, when you're more established, it's picking your paths of how do you then keep iterating and developing that software to make it work. And it's a challenge we've had on Piston Heads to some extent. And it's still there on Piston Heads. If you look at our forum is written in classic ASP. Now we're looking at sort of, you know, cutting edge technology in 1752 rather than, you know, 2021 where we are, and you can't find anyone who can actually develop it. So it's about trying to break that down in a sensible way that means that you can keep moving and introducing new innovative ideas without holding yourself back.
Well, how do you look at it then when you're looking at new tech stacks? How do you look at it? Do you think we can improve this? Let's look for new technology to help improve that. Or do you find the technology and then go, that will be useful to implement here, here, and here?
I think it's about finding features and business ideas that can advance your organization and then retro trying to fit of how does that then fit into my tech stack and how do I separate my tech stack to make that work. So it's not about going, oh, we'll rebuild a section of the site just because we want to move it to the next technology. Now there are advantages to that, which is, okay, it's much better to get, you know, get engineers in to work on it because it's a later stack. It's, you know, improve technical debt because you can get things out faster.
Yeah.
But the challenge is that it doesn't actually then move the business on because you've just rebuilt the same thing. So to a consumer on the end, it doesn't make any difference. So the idea is really to go, well, I need to develop a new feature. So say I want to put a search across the whole of our forum and I want to make that search function work really well. Yeah. So there you go. Well, we'll actually go out and look at, okay, what search technologies are there out there? Whether we go Elasticsearch or Solr or, you know, use some of the new fangled stuff that's on AWS and sort of make those choices to then go, well, we're building the technology to make sure that we're improving the features on the site and breaking it down like that. And then the other thing is really, and I have to say this as a head of architecture from two previous companies, is you then try and work on Conway's law to some extent, which is that you build systems which match your organizational structure and sort of financial structure to some extent. So we try and do that in a technology way, which is go, well, actually, if we do a separation of the front end from the back end, or trying to separate out from APIs to something that's consuming those APIs, we can create that separation and build teams to sort of match that separation.
And there's another point that I'd like to bring up, which is not something that I've really mentioned on the podcast before. So when you're making those business changes, how do you empower the engineers, or how do you connect business value to what the engineering team is doing, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It's a really important thing for me, which I think gets missed by a lot of companies and to the engineering level, which is I really like my engineers and my teams to fully understand why they're doing something, what difference it actually makes to the business. And I think the key to that and to having disparate teams who are trying to work on stuff is to understand, well, what is the one key thing that makes a difference to your business? Now, most of the answers is like, well, it's be, you know, revenue growth or expenditure savings or profitability, depending on where the company is in its growth. But really, it's going, there's something underneath that which is driving that. You know, if you use the example like airline and EasyJet, I think they care about, does a plane land on time? That's all they care about. That's their number one thing, because that tells them that every single thing underneath that is lined up and working. You know, the catering staff are redoing planes in time. They're turning around the fuel. You know, the plane's flying in time. It's landing on time. So it's as a business trying to work out what that is. So it's our North Star to go, well, you know, leads to dealers on our classified section is probably our number one North Star, because that's why dealers sign up with us to list their classified adverts, and why they go on Piston Heads is they want leads. So all the teams are drive towards those leads. And then you can drive back from like the top of the pyramid of leads and go, well, what actually improves leads? Stuff like customer experience improves it, you know, end user performance, conversion rates, engagement on the site. So you can start doing those kind of customer experience level. And then you drop down to, okay, what actually the engineers do, which is application infrastructure performance. So you can look at stuff like app performance, slow queries, queue lengths, because they all affect that customer experience, which then affects the leads at the top. And you can even go as far as, you know, mean time to release and go, well, if you can release things quicker, you can then do maybe A-B testing quicker, which then can look at how improvements are made to those lead conversions right at the top. So it's always making sure the engineers understand that the reason they're doing something is because they're trying to drive towards this top level single thing that we're trying to make a difference on.
Yeah. And how do you show them that? How do you show them the value? Is it just by saying this is what the value is that you're adding to the business? Or is it by showing the bottom line and then saying you've improved it, you've helped improve us by this much? Or how do you actually physically show?
We're quite open on showing the bottom line and what's actually happening, but that's not the key thing that sort of we present to engineers or any of the teams that sort of run underneath me. So the really important thing is making sure that you have a really good data lake that you can throw data into to surface really good dashboards out on. So the thing we've built is that every day we get a dashboard which has kind of key metrics that we care about across the organization. So the engineering dashboard, you know, numbers, it's not got, you know, oh, what's the number, how many bugs, percentage and stuff like that. They're kind of important, but they sit lower down. But the number one dashboard they read is how many visitors we've had to the site, how many leads we've had, what the conversion rate is, and then trends over time across those things. And that's kind of the top stuff. And then you get slightly down to the customer experience stuff, which is, okay, well, let's look at Core Web Vital scores and app performance scores and AWS costs. So they all sit there. So that's kind of the thing that the engineers are looking at on a daily basis. So if they suddenly see, you know, one of those metrics moves, they're thinking, okay, well, what's caused that change? What can I do to affect it or make a suggestion to change it?
And how do you measure the business success across different departments?
So once you've got that North Star of leads, then that transcends to across all the teams. So I've got an editorial team that sits under me. They sit there writing articles about new cars, going out and test driving them, They got the best job in the world because they get to drive Ferraris and Porsches and Lamborghinis all
really?
The time.
Is that right? Really?
Yep. Incredibly envious of them, but it's what they do, and they're really good at it. So they go out and do that. But the purpose of that is it's a marketing tool to try and drive people to where we make our revenue. So when they're writing editorial strategy or choosing what their editorial strategy is, they're going, well, how can this then drive towards leads in classifieds? Or they kind of, the secondary one, go, well, advertising revenue sort of sits there as well. So what brings the audience in? So they're thinking about those things. And then the same when you go to the consumer marketing team, they're going, well, how do you drive appropriate audience in? Because you can drive lots of audience in, but appropriate audience in that then convert to leads as well. So it's making sure that North Star's there across all teams and they're all driving towards it.
You must have a lot of dependency on data.
Yeah, I think data is key. It's what the company's kind of founded on, which is make smart decisions based off data. So I was sort of saying that the really key important thing is making sure you're getting your data into somewhere where you can then analyze it in an appropriate way. And it's sort of splits between two. It's getting those known questions out and surfacing them in dashboards, which we're sort of talking about, you know, what's my conversion rate? How many leads have I got? What leads editorials driven or consumer marketing have driven? But it's also then having a data lake that allows you to just ask ad hoc questions of the data. So you come up with a hypothesis and go, well, okay, well, what does that mean? And if you've got a really good data lake with all the data coming into it, you can then go, right, I'm going to ask that question and I can get some answers out to at least drive direction of what I want to do for a product or from an editorial strategy or from a consumer marketing point of view as well.
I was just wondering, you know, I speak to a lot of businesses and we mention data quite a lot. And do you find, you know, not particularly in CarGurus or Piston Heads, but do you find that sometimes data could hinder creativity?
I think the bit where data could be hindrance on, okay, say, a creativity is very much if you take the editorial teams, and you could do this for product engineering as well. But for the editorial teams, you're going, well, you know, writing an article and choosing what car to write about, there's a bit of sort of dark art about it. Now, if you went fully on the data, you would go, well, I'll go on to Google and I'll look at what the top search terms are. If I was going to do a twin test between two cars, I'll try and work out, you know, which cars are being searched for, and I'll write around that content. And you've got to have certain kind of creativity around it, because, you know, if you had a strategy that did that, you'd probably do pretty well and you'd get that organic audience coming in because you're trying to hit the search terms. But the other method, just trying to work on engagement and metrics and just what it does as a kind of editorial tone. I think you have to then have that creativity to it as well. And the same on the product side. The product side, you know, I'm sure there's lots of listeners here who, you know, you come up with ideas and you think, right, okay, we'll do that. And that will make a difference. Or I've looked at the data and I'll do this and that'll make a difference. And there was a good example in previous work with, I remember B&Q had, this is just sort of like taking decisions based off and using the data to actually solve it. But they had a thing where on their confirmation screen, they had the acceptance terms at the top and the bottom of the screen. And it was a mistake. Somebody had just launched it with this mistake in there. But the way everything was done was with A/B testing. So you don't make a change to the website without A/B testing and seeing what impact that has on completion rates and forms. So they went, oh, this is a mistake. Obviously, we've just got to remove it and get it back. So they put it for an A/B test. So they removed these double terms and conditions and conversion dropped. And they were like, okay, well, that's a bit strange. So I think even though there's a creativity to it and you can take, you know, being an expertise in, you know, internet and user experience and trying to think what you think will happen, I do think data is really important, that you back everything you up with data, even if it's post the effect, and just put it out and see what difference it made. So I would guess, you know, you'd come up with 10 experiments that we'll try on the site, and it would be generally good. And you'll get user experience. People go, well, people's eyesight goes in kind of an F pattern through the page, or they scroll down. And then you do a test on it and you'll find that conversion drops off and you're like, okay, well, that wasn't right. And you probably find 7 out of 10 fail.
That's so interesting.
So I do think it's important to use the data to back up your hypothesis,
right?
And solve it in that way, because you're only made up of the experiences you've had, and you really, you know, you've got millions of users using the site. They're all different types of people, it really, you can't predict what they'll do.
God, it's interesting, isn't it? I find data absolutely fascinating because, you know, when you look at data, you can basically see anything you want really in the data. The answer's in the eye of the beholder, basically.
But that's where data's, but it's how you interpret the data is really important.
Yeah, exactly.
You can make wrong decisions based on not having all the information you want. There was a really good example. It was a clothing shop that actually used data to try and work out, okay, what's our best audience segment to go and market at? And they found that there's a load of shoppers who go in at lunch times in their working life, and they would go and buy loads of clothes. And they were like, wow, these people buy the most clothes out of anyone. Right, we should market these people, try and get them to buy more clothes. Off they go.
Yeah.
The bit of data they were missing is they didn't know the return rate of those people who went and bought those clothes.
Right.
And it turned out the return rate was stupidly high, like 90-odd%. So they were targeting all their marketing spend at a group that cost them money because the return shipping was a massive problem. So you really have to be careful about making sure you know the whole picture to make a decision on data, and also to make sure that, you know, there's so much data you can get blinded by it, you know. So that's why it's trying to narrow down to what are your one or two, three key things you're trying to measure, and then making sure that data is supporting it.
And kind of, I imagine with the clothing industry and fashion, I imagine that certain times of the year they'll have certain trends, like, you know, in maybe September, people will start buying winter jackets and things like that. Is there any, in terms of, you know, car purchasing, is there any kind of trends there throughout the year, or any trends in general?
Yeah, so you do see some trends, and I'd say the car industry is in, like, it's really hard to predict at the moment because the chip issues that are going on, you know, there's new cars not coming out. It's messed up the industry to some extent. Used car values have flown up by, you know, 30% kind of stuff across the board. But you do, in usual times, which I'm never sure if we're ever going to be back in those, but in usual times, yeah, you'll see kind of the standard trends you expect, which is convertibles do really well in the spring.
Right, okay.
Yeah, 4x4s do really well in the autumn as you approach Christmas. And then you see fluctuations around new registrations. So new reg comes out in March, new reg comes out in September. You see kind of that fluctuation of volume go around those things as well. But there's also trends we've seen over the time. So, you know, work on Piston Heads, which doesn't really work as a name for the sort of electric vehicle world coming up.
Oh, yeah.
We'll claim there's pistons somewhere in the car. I'm sure there's some in the brakes or something. But the challenge of that, we've seen kind of EV growth change. So I think there's not necessarily cyclic seasonal changes, but you're seeing changes of purchase patterns over time as sort of the industry moves. And you can see it even in just, if you look at colors can be a really interesting thing to just look at time, sort of changes in how those colors work. You know, if you go back probably 12 years, you'll find that, you know, reds and blues were really more popular. Now it's blacks, silvers, colors as well. So it's interesting how that changed. And what I'm fascinated is that change driven by consumer demand, or is that changed by the manufacturers themselves just changing what their color palettes are? It's fascinating to look at.
God, that is really interesting. Another fascinating insight into data there for you. And also, I'd really like to talk about leadership and you as a leader, Pete. Just to kick things off with this, what would you say is the most important aspect of leadership?
And for me, it's coaching. It is really just it's driving direction and coaching people are the two things.
Yeah,
I had a good conversation with a guy called George Goley, who was one of the beginning people at Microsoft, and they went off. He was running Argos and now back in the US doing stuff. And I had a conversation with him, and really he stated that you get to a point in your career where you either build things or you leave people who build things. You can't do both. It's hard to do both because you sort of switch between the two. I kind of switched to more leading things than building things. I build things in my spare time, but, you know, I've got great engineers who are much better than me and do all this kind of stuff. And for me, it's really about making sure that you sell a vision and you coach people to success. And the thing that gives me satisfaction, and this is going to sound really corny, is just watching people that you've managed or led, you know, go off and do great things, even if they're inside your company or outside the company. That's that's the thing I really like is just seeing growth of sort of people as you kind of try and help them through the market. And I think when they then come back and say things that you've said, that's kind of where you go, okay, they get it, which is, you know, a team who are going, oh, just look at the data on that and do that stuff. I'm like, yes, we've achieved success. They're understanding it and understanding, you know, the decisions you need to make to be a business. And I think the challenge of engineers is engineers just want to build cool stuff.
Yeah.
And it's making sure you do that leap between building cool stuff and making a difference to the business. And the amount of code reviews I've done on companies that previous companies have been looking to buy and going, it's got a really good business model. You go and look at the code base and it's absolutely rubbish. Mm. As I always say to the engineers, you know, you are never going to have a successful, would you rather have an unsuccessful company with the best code in the world or a really successful business with not very good code? You know, the people running the business, they care about the latter. So it's always a fine line trying to play with that. And it's leading people to make sure they understand the reason why they have a job and it is to make profitability for a company.
Do you think you can be taught leadership, or do you think some of it has to be kind of innate? Does it have to be in you to start with?
It's an interesting question. Do I think you could teach leadership? I would like to hope so.
Mm.
I think you see it naturally. Go and watch any TV, reality TV show, you see there's natural leaders who come out and there's natural people who don't.
Yeah.
And if you go back to right at the beginning when I tried to be a pilot at the RAF, and so I had this scholarship through sixth form. As part of that scholarship, you went and did a lot of officer training. Mm. And the selection procedure and officer training is all about leadership. So they'll naturally just put a group of people into a room and see who comes out kind of as trying to lead the teams. People have innate ability to be leaders and not, but I don't think that doesn't exclude them from being able to do it.
Yeah.
It's just, it comes more natural to others. I think the thing that sort of gets missed is difference between leadership and management as well. You know, management is being able to run, you know, a team day by day and, you know, just deal with the things you need to do as a manager, hit targets, that kind of stuff. Leadership is about more or less vision setting and telling the story of where we're trying to go as a business and exciting people to make that work. And I think there is a separation between that. And you can see that in, you know, if you look at politicians, you know, you probably go, Churchill wasn't a great manager, but he was a great visionary leader. You know, he could tell a good story. But you know, soon as the war ended and you needed someone to manage the economy and manage the country, you know, he wasn't the right person for it. So I think there is a separation between those two as well to make sure that works.
Yeah. And you mentioned being a visionary leader and kind of almost selling the vision of, you know, the next step, essentially. Would you ever sell something that you don't agree with?
I find it hard to do that, I must admit. Yeah, I think people see fakeness. I think, you know, people can see through it. So I think you have to be incredibly passionate and believe in what you're trying to sell. So I think it's really important.
Yeah.
You know, I find it hard. I'm trying to think if I've been in a role where I do that. I'm not sure I have, but I choose roles where I see future progression and future vision and something that I can then sell to the team and sell to building a team going, this is what we're trying to achieve and off we go to do it. Cause I think that is the right thing to do. So yeah, I don't think I've luckily not been in that position to do that.
You've spoken at a lot of conferences, I believe, and I've got a list of them here. Google's Adopt or Die, MongoDB Meetup, Elasticsearch Breakfast Seminar, and Figaro Digital Conference. So how did you get into that in the first place? What happens there? Do you approach them and say, I'd like to speak, or do they approach you?
Yeah, you make the list sound far more impressive than it probably is. Yeah, so for some of the stuff, it's around relationships. I think, you know, you work with companies, you try and do great things with them, and then they like, well, this is a good opportunity for us to sell what we do.
Right.
So if you go and speak at a conference, then they will help, you know, it helps sell their product. So that's kind of probably how you get into it. It's just building really good stuff and being able to talk about it. As opposed to kind of why I did it, which is more interesting. It goes back to your earlier question, which is, can you teach your leadership or not? I, you know, my personality type, and I like doing these kind of Maya Briggs or insight personality types, is that communication is kind of one of the lower skills. I do not like talking. I don't know, like talking out loud in front of people. And right. to progress sort of in my career, I realized that you need to be able to do that. And if I look at my, I'm a massively introverted personality, which might not come across here because I'm chatting. It's quite easy. It's two people. But if you look at quite a lot of the leaders out there, they're massively extroverts. And so being extroverted out in the world is something you need to do to sort of create that vision and be a leader. So it's very much about trying to have to learn to be that kind of good communicator, good storyteller, and be able to then, you know, have a vision. So what I did was, well, what's the best way to jump in the deep end to be able to do that? The best way to jump in the deep end to do that is to start talking at conferences.
Wow.
And you know, you can fail. It was that, or I hadn't had another thought on how to do it, which is a stand-up comedy course.
Oh my God.
Now I never which I think is like throwing yourself into the middle of the North Sea quite on that kind of stuff, because wouldn't really like to do that. But stand-up comedy, if anyone out there really wants to learn how to do public speaking, go and do that. Because that's scary as hell, but it teaches you how to do storytelling,
yeah.
how to make sure you engage the audience, and yeah. how to deliver something yeah. in a really effective way. That I think that's probably the best way to go and learn how to do, you know, talking in front of people, because there can't be anything worse than that. Once you've done that, then it must be a doddle after that.
Yeah.
I didn't go down the route. I went for just let's go and talk at conferences and try and work it out. But I think with anything, it's like I try and coach people below me, but I think you just need to do something and put yourself out there and watch videos or try and get coached on it, on how to talk, you know, record yourself back and listen to yourself.
Yeah.
Which is a horrible thing to do in itself.
Oh, tell me about it. Yeah. I listen to myself every day. You never get used to it, Pete.
No, it's horrible. And I try and say that, as you know, we do, even if it's an internal meeting, you're going to do a quarterly business review or do a presentation to a team of people. Mm. If it's a recording, I do encourage my team, go and listen to yourself back and try and pick out, you know, it's cringeworthy, it's horrible, but to be the best, you need to,
yeah,
you know, look at yourself, coach yourself and train. You know, if you look at the best sportsmen out there in the world, it's not like Lewis Hamilton's at the top of the tree and going, well, that's it, right? I don't need to teach. He's got driver coaching. He's got people looking at everything all the time. Same as the top golfers. They're getting coached all the time. So I think, yeah, you just not be frightened to sort of self-evaluate, ask other people's opinions and get stuff back. And I think that was the purpose of doing the conference speeches, was really about being comfortable talking to 1,500 people in a room.
Wow, 1,500 people, really?
Is that one of them, yeah.
So the God, that,
yeah.
That is really scary. I think, though, public speaking, although it's incredibly nerve-wracking, and it is, I mean, I would find it terrifying, but it's one of those things that you can learn and you can get better at, and you can manage that as well. And also, I think expanding your comfort zone is so important, even in everyday life. And in terms of expanding your comfort zone in your career, that is, public speaking is one of those things that will massively help your career progression. So yeah, totally well worth doing. Have you got any coming up?
I haven't actually. It's been a strange time, isn't it?
Yeah, there's
been not much going on. What I'm trying to do is encourage my teams to go and do it, so I can take a kind of back step for the moment and not go and do that kind of stuff. But I like my team to go and talk at meetups, but it has other benefits. You know, there is benefits to being able to talk better in a public group. You know, I run a UK sort of town hall on a bi-weekly basis, which is to, you know, 100 odd people. It gives you confidence just to go and do that, which before would have been really nerve-wracking. But the other thing of going to a conference is, one, it raises your profile. You know, one of the jobs I got was because I talked at a conference, because I got approached and had chatted about it. Cool. And the other thing is, it's just really good for getting out there and showing what your company does to encourage new engineers and engineering applicants. So that's kind of, it has side effect benefits as well as just personal development.
Yeah. I find it really interesting these days as well. There's something across my mind a couple of days ago that only in kind of quite recent times we've had technology leaders very, very much in the public eye. I mean, I'm talking the likes of like Elon Musk, and we've got Jeff Bezos, who's Amazon, I believe. And I find it really interesting that it's only kind of in recent times that we've got these powerful technology leaders very much in the public eye. You know, I think that's quite inspiring for a lot of people.
No, I'd agree with that. You, I'd add Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook as well. Yeah, I think the two things that I like about it to some extent, right? Some of them are funny characters, let's put it that way. You know, we read some of their autobiographies and books and watch them, you know, stand in front of a US Senate hearing. But the thing that's really good is that I think, you know, if you go back 10 years and you look at the leaders in an organization and who can become a CEO,
yeah,
you know, their path to success mainly comes from the sales side of the organization, mm-hmm. up, because they kind of understand that kind of selling and how to increase revenue or profitability. But it's all extroverts out there. You know, there's not many introverts who do that kind of stuff. And I think with, you know, these growth of these technology companies and having technology leaders show that, one, you can come up to leading an organization from a technology background and from technology platform. And two, that you don't have to all be massive extroverts. You can be introverts to do it. And I think it's understanding that if you know your type, if you're ever an extrovert or an introvert, that's what we talk about, me being an introvert, that doesn't exclude you from being able to be extroverted. You know, it's very much like you can write with your right hand, but you can teach your left hand to write after time. It just takes time to do. But the thing you have to learn is, okay, well, how do you get your energy back? And introverted is about your energy back is just taking yourself away and being quiet and just, you know, staring at a wall and thinking, that kind of stuff. Well, extroverts get their energy back by being surrounded by people. And as long as you understand how you then recharge your energy, you can be any of those things to some extent. You just need to have the break to do it. And that's quite good for your mental health as well.
I couldn't agree more, actually. It's about finding that balance, isn't it? You know, it's like, I mean, even for me, I would say my balance would be, I feel myself as an introvert as well. So I would say I can go in the, nowadays, I look back at how I used to go into the office every day, 5 days a week, surrounded by people, busy atmosphere all the time. And I can't believe that I used to manage that. I can't believe that I wasn't completely drained all the time. So it's about finding that balance. And I think nowadays with people having the ability to work from home as often as they like, pretty much in most businesses, I think it's easier nowadays to find that balance.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think, yeah, if anything, the last 2 years have taught us is that kind of work-life balance and the different ways to get productivity out of people is sort of more come to the forefront. And that actually organizations still can be productive without 5 days a week and presenteeism really going on. And I think even before then, you saw kind of the introverts, you could tell they're the ones with the headphones on, you know, just listening to music to drown out everything else around them. So you could argue that even being in an office with headphones on, which I know some companies are like, oh, you can't wear headphones, that kind of stuff. There's very old school mentality on how to approach productivity and work, probably going back 5 years kind of stuff. And that has changed massively. And I think this pandemic has moved the needle really quickly on actually new working environments. And I'm very for that, you know, as a working environment, you should always give people three working environments. So you give them a busy office, a shared office, you give them a quiet space in office, or you give them the ability to work at home. And you treat them as grown-ups to make the decisions on what is based for the work they're doing on which choice they make after that, rather than setting quotas or trying to have people in the office so many times. That's kind of where you want to be. And then you performance measure them. So if they're not doing their job well, then they're not doing that balance right, or you coach them to be able to manage that. But I think that's kind of where we're moving to as kind of a working environment. And I think that's much better, because it just, the balance is much better across everything, especially those who, you know, I don't commute into Manchester or Leeds or London or Birmingham kind of stuff. You know, some of the, you know, you can't afford houses in some of those places in the middle. So your commute times, you know, you're looking at 1 to 2 to, you know, some people in London's 4 hours, 5 hours a day.
Wow.
It's hard to maintain that. And
yeah.
And I think people have looked at it and gone, why did I do that 5 days a week? That is absolutely mental.
Yeah.
I've chosen to do that. So I think it's improved massively. Now it's really how do companies react to that over the next year is interesting to what they want to do, because there's a lot of expensive office space that they've spent a lot of money on, which they'll probably sit there and go, well, why have I got this really expensive office space if I've only got people occupying it 30% of the time.
Yeah, yeah. I don't envy those companies who have taken out kind of 20-year leases on their place in central London.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I could really sit here all day and chat to you. But I think, because obviously you're a very busy man, we could wrap up in a shortly. But before we go, I'd like to just throw a little game on you now, if you don't mind. It's kind of a wordplay association game, where I'll just say I've got three words that I've jotted down throughout as we've been talking, and if I could get your immediate thoughts on those words, that would be great.
Okay.
So the first one, round one, is leadership.
Leadership. So leadership is about setting a vision mm-hmm. for your organization, setting a vision for people, and making sure they become the best that they can become. If that wasn't corny enough to answer.
That was excellent. The second one is public speaking.
Public speaking. Try it. Mm-hmm. Do it. It's a great way to develop your skills around it. I think it takes, from what I hear, it's like 20 days to change anything. You know, if you do something for 20 times, then at least you become, you know, good at it.
Right.
So I'd say get out there, volunteer, go out, and if all else fails, go and do a stand-up course.
And the final one, Elon Musk.
Elon Musk. Yeah. Wow. Okay. First, what's Elon Musk? One thing I like about Elon Musk is he doesn't seem to have any limits to what he wants to come up with. So I think there's one thing to learn from is just being incredibly limitless about your opportunities. And I think he just, if you look at the things he tries to achieve, it's not about, oh, well, I can't do that because of this X, Y, and Z. He's like, I'm just going to do it to some extent. I'm going to put a car in space. I'm going to try and come up with, you know, a way to fuel all my Tesla so people don't have to worry about it. The recent one was I'm going to open up my charge network for other companies to use, because there are certain companies that don't do that kind of stuff. I think he's, from that, it's like limitless possibilities. That's probably Elon Musk's.
Yeah, I find these business leaders quite inspiring, really, because like you said, there's no boundaries with them. And it feels like, you know, with Elon Musk, didn't he start his first website in his dorm room at college or something, and he went on to sell it for like $20 million or something?
That's same as Mosul, isn't it?
yeah, probably. Well, yeah, it is, isn't it? But isn't that inspiring for, like, you know, young engineers to think, Jesus, I could just learn how to do this, come up with an idea, and it just must be so inspiring to think basically anything is possible.
I think so. You know, Google started in a garage, and they wrapped their servers with Lego or something like that, I remember rightly. And you know, Facebook was started as just a way for people to know faces around university campuses.
Incredible.
It is amazing how these organizations, have grown really well. But I think the key to that is, anyone can do it, but you have to have something that has consumer demand, and you have to know what you're measuring to get there.
Yeah. Wise words, Pete. All right. Well, I think that might wrap us up today. Although I genuinely could sit here for hours and chat to you, Pete, honestly. But thanks for taking the time to do this. I've really enjoyed chatting to you.
No problem. Well, thank you very much, Ben, for hosting. And don't throw any more games at me like that at the end.
I know. I massively put you on the spot there. Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.